Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Sumi Somaskander from the Global Story podcast, where we're asking how the US election could impact the war in Ukraine. With Kamala Harris and Donald Trump neck and neck in the polls, President Zelensky's campaign to ensure crucial funds don't run out is increasingly uncertain. So will the result in November change his nation's fate? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in London. I'm Tim Franks. Pretty much every day we get updates from health officials in Gaza. They're the casualty figures since October the 7th last year. Today's numbers, 42,344 Palestinians have been killed, 99,013 have been injured. They're figures which defy easy comprehension, partly because they're so big, and partly, of course, because they're hotly disputed. Israel says that, firstly, you can't trust the Hamas-run health ministry, and secondly, they don't take account of the large number of militants whom they've killed. But by any definition, the suffering in Gaza has been immense this past year. And it's not just about those who've died, but those who are struggling, in the worst circumstances, just to live. Since the first days of the Israeli offensive, following the Hamas-led massacre of 1,200 Israelis, Khalid, a father of five children, and Aya, a 23-year-old law graduate, have been documenting their struggle to survive. BBC Eye's Lara El-Ghabali has their story. It's a report which includes distressing details.
On a table in his apartment, Khalid is dressing the wounds of a young boy.
When the war started, I opened a medical center in my house. I'm a physiotherapist, not really a doctor. This was a big change for me.
Khalid lives in Jabalia, in northern Gaza, one of the areas worst affected by the war. A week into the war in October 2023, the Israeli army told people to evacuate the area and head south. Khalid's four-year-old daughter, Halum, says she doesn't want to leave. Because, she adds, I'm scared of the missiles. With hospitals stretched, Khalid feels that he has to stay and help.
Today I dealt with a child. He was still breathing. If we'd had the means, we would have operated on his brain because he had a hemorrhage. But unfortunately, we had to let him die. There was nothing we could do for him.
Aya was also in northern Gaza, but as the fighting got closer, she moved with her parents and seven siblings to the center.
I came to this shelter school in October. The school seems like the safest place to be at the moment.
In Gaza, nowhere is safe for long. A building next to the school was hit.
There, they've got someone out. Oh my God, body parts.
Khalid and his family in the north are also under threat. In December, a nearby airstrike rocks Khalid's house. I'm afraid, his daughter Halum says. The war is ever-present, even in their games. Khalid watches as his son, Hamoud, pretends to perform surgery on a tiny doll. She's injured, he says. Rubble fell on her.
When I see them like this, my heart breaks. These are not games children should play.
Aya and her family have had to move south to Rafah, where a million people are sheltering.
We're literally living like animals here. We've just received news that our house was destroyed. What do you mean I won't go back to my home, my bed, my room, or anything?
By April, food is running dangerously low. Aeroplanes begin dropping aid.
The amount of aid that falls is very, very small. They are chasing the aid drops. People are fighting each other. People are trying to get aid from the parachutes that were dropped into the sea. Someone's being dragged out now. He was trying to get the aid.
With no food, Khaled's family have to resort to desperate measures. Khaled's children are eating raw weeds.
We eat things knowing that they might poison us. But we do it because there is no alternative.
In June, Aya receives some devastating news.
I lost one of my ankles right now.
She posts a video to social media, speaking English this time, so the world can hear.
No one cares about us. We lost our families, our friends, and no one cares about this.
The words of Aya in Gaza, and you can watch the full documentary Life and Death in Gaza on iPlayer if you're in the United Kingdom, and internationally on the BBC World Service YouTube channel. This is a war that Israel is conducting, of course, on multiple fronts. There are fierce clashes in Lebanon. We'll be heading to our correspondent in Beirut in about 25 minutes. And there's intense speculation over how and when Israel will hit back against Iran following its barrage of almost 200 missiles directed at Israel 2 weeks ago. That speculation has increased with a piece in the Washington Post newspaper suggesting that the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has assured the Biden administration that it won't hit Iranian nuclear or oil facilities, but rather just target military installations. In response, Mr. Netanyahu's office then put out a statement saying that it will make its own decisions based on national interest. Gail Talshir is Professor of Political Science at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. What does she make of these signals?
I think that Netanyahu has two fronts, except, of course, the military fronts that he's dealing with. One is the relationship between the U.S. and Israel, and the second is political arena that he's facing back home. And in terms of this political arena back home, he needs to be projecting to his own coalition that he is the strong leader and he makes decisions on the basis of Israeli interests solely without being determining that by the U.S. So in a way, Netanyahu plays American politics. He knows that he has a window of opportunity of 3 weeks to retaliate against the strike that came from Iran.
You're saying 3 weeks because it's 3 weeks to the U.S. presidential election. But why is that, in a sense, the deadline?
It is the deadline because afterwards, Biden administration is going to be much more free to pressurize Israel, basically. So within these 3 weeks, on the one hand, Netanyahu doesn't want to escalate into an all-out regional war. On the second hand, he knows that he has a freer hand from Washington because Washington cannot be seen as opposing Israeli response at this time. So this is the window of 3 weeks. And afterwards, it doesn't seem as if it's going to end because it looks already as if Iran is going to retaliate. So we might see escalation, even if it's not going to be within this window of opportunities.
What do you make of another dynamic that some people have raised here, which is actually that part of Netanyahu's calculations might be that precisely he could potentially influence the outcome of the US election were he to choose to do so in the way in which he hits back against Iran? For example, were he to go after the oil infrastructure, that could cause a spike in the oil price, and that would hurt potentially the Democrats. And he is seen as being somebody who is perhaps closer to Donald Trump, and also potentially scupper the chances of Kamala Harris coming in and maybe reopening negotiations with Iran over a nuclear deal. Do you think that's people sort of reaching too hard for trying to work out what the motives here might be, or do you think there's some validity in that?
There is some validity, but it's not as obvious that you make it sound. So, first of all, it's not the oil prices are not going to be picking up in a week's time. It's going to take time. So I don't think that's the game that Netanyahu is playing. But it is clear that Netanyahu did not take a deal with the Saudis, which could have ended up the Gaza affair, probably because he's waiting for either Trump or to see what results of the elections are going to be. So it is definitely a factor in how Netanyahu calculates his own steps, but he's the prime minister of Israel. So what he's looking at is the kind of response against Iran which could deliver what he wants, which is to bring back the deterrence that Israel had and to give Israel a free hand to basically go after the infrastructures of the terror organizations Hezbollah in Lebanon. And it's clear that Netanyahu is also playing politics, internal politics, meaning that he doesn't want to be seen as working by the dictation of the US because of internal politics in his own coalition.
And can I pick you up on that? Because it's something that you also mentioned at the start of the interview. I mean, clearly, a year ago, he was immensely weakened by the disaster of October the 7th. But there is a reading that actually the opinion polls suggest that he has regained some popularity recently. How strong do you think he is at the moment, given the shape of his coalition, and how far do you think he is being pushed by his ultra-nationalist hard right?
I think that to read what Netanyahu is doing over the last year, you have to understand that it would have made the perfect sense for Netanyahu the day after October 7 to basically have a broad coalition of a national unity government, which he did only for very few months. And then he dismissed this national unity government because he wants to remain in power with this extremist coalition that he now controls. So definitely from Netanyahu's perspective, the pressure that he gets from his extremist right wing is influencing the way that he is conducting himself both in Gaza and in Lebanon. And we hope that this is not too much of an influence vis-a-vis Iran, because these radicals in his coalition have very different plans than Netanyahu himself for Gaza and the south of Lebanon. They basically want to have Jewish settlements over there, which is something that is against the interest of Israel and also against what Netanyahu is actually leading. But since they are such an important factor of Netanyahu remaining for the next 2 years in power, it means that he has to give some consideration to their pressures. And this is why we haven't seen an agreement coming with the Saudis and the Americans concerning Gaza. And this is why he wants to remain the strong leader that he projects to be vis-a-vis his base. So to answer your original question, yes, Netanyahu is now much stronger than he was on October 7, but still in the polls, the current coalition does not have a majority. Had he went for elections, early elections last year or half a year later or today, he would still lose the election. So this Israeli government, actually, if you look at the polls, does not have the legitimacy from the people. This is why Netanyahu has to play between the extremists who pull him to the extreme and the mainstream in Israel, which wants to think about national security of Israel and not the political considerations of Netanyahu and his coalition.
And that was Gael Talshir, Professor of Political Science at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. You're listening to NewsHour. Coming up on the programme, we'll hear from the Saudi ambassador to the United Kingdom about his take on the conflict in the Middle East.
By and large, I think most of us are trying to de-escalate the situation. It's only a few weeks ago we were talking about ceasefire in Gaza, then a ceasefire in Lebanon. And what we're trying to avoid is having to discuss a ceasefire in Iran as well, and then further conflict around the region. I hope it doesn't escalate. You know, all of us suffer in the region, and if we all suffer in our region, being so pivotal to the world suffers.
More on that in about 20 minutes. Headlines this hour. The United Nations Human Rights Office has called for an investigation into Monday's airstrike by Israel, which killed 24 people in northern Lebanon. We'll hear from our correspondent in Beirut in about 15 minutes. And there's been a sharp fall in irregular migration to the European Union since January this year. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC in London with me, Tim Franks. It's one of the most militarised, most impenetrable borders in the world. The DMZ that jags across the Korean Peninsula has done so for decades. So you might be surprised to hear that there are roads which still run up to either side of that border, offering a symbolic possibility of connection between the two countries, north and south. Or more accurately, as of today, I should say, they did offer. Because North Korea has blown up several of the roads on its side. It seems to be wanting to signal increasing displeasure with South Korea. Sung-Yun Lee is a global fellow at the Washington-based think tank, the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. What does he make of what's going on with North Korea?
Contrary to the popular view that North Korea is half crazy, they are prone to lashing out, making weird, blusterous statements. North Korea is very careful, and the latest demolition politics, if you will, is part of an elaborate strategy of theatrics and political warfare. What North Korea does is to provoke, escalate in increments, so that when they resort to a major provocation like another nuclear test or an intercontinental ballistic missile test, much of the world somehow will be prone to blaming the United States or South Korea, North Korea's main adversaries, instead of North Korea, that those nations too bear some blame for this cycle of mutual escalation.
I mean, that's interesting. You think this is sort of part of the sort of background noise to perhaps something more serious happening down the road. But why do you think that it follows from there that countries may end up blaming the South or the US for somehow provoking North Korea?
Because North Korea is eminently backward. They are such a weird amalgam of medieval weird mores and buffoonish bellicosity, we tend to naturally patronize North Korea. South Korea is at least 50 times richer than North Korea. The United States is the most powerful nation in the world. So those two advanced big powers should be making more concessions. They should be kinder and nicer to North Korea. That is the very fundamental, very basic but understandable perspective that many people have. So when North Korea lashes out, it must be, people are prone to thinking, a reaction to South Korean provocations, hostile policy emanating from Seoul or from Washington, D.C., whereas over the past decades, it's been North Korea that's been the driver, resorting to often lethal provocations. And a demolition job is innately theatrical. You see plumes of smoke going up, loud banging noise. There's an olfactory, visual, auditory component in all this display. So it makes an impression. And when North Korea resorts to another next level escalation, people will remember that South Korea was very impolite or critical of North Korea, that the United States was issuing warnings. So those gestures probably led North Korea to resort to even a bigger provocation. I know it doesn't make any sense, but that's what North Korea excels in.
Do you see this as part of a cyclical turn of events, that we're used to seeing tensions rise and then maybe abate on the peninsula over many years? Or do you think that actually we are entering a phase which is potentially more dangerous? I mean, I'm thinking that, you know, just a few months ago, Kim Jong-un formally withdrew the goal of peaceful unification of the peninsula from state propaganda. Do you think that we are moving into a potentially more dangerous moment?
I do, absolutely. And that's because North Korea's capabilities, its nuclear and missile capabilities today, are far stronger than, say, 5 years ago or even 3 years ago. So North Korea now, it feels emboldened to push the envelope even further. And on the eve of a major presidential election in the United States, what better time than grow its net value by exporting insecurity, by issuing threats?
And that was Sung-Yun Lee from the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He was speaking to me from Seoul. Google is going nuclear, or so it's planning. It's placed an order for several small reactors to power its data centres which are ever more energy hungry because of the demands of generative artificial intelligence. Rory Monaghan is Professor of Energy Systems Engineering at the University of Galway in Ireland.
If you were to compare, for example, a ChatGPT query with a Google query, you'd be looking at roughly a 10 times increase in power demand to perform one query. Now, not every data center into the future is purely going to be handling generative AI queries, but this 10 times difference, even allowing for some improvements in efficiency in the AI processes going forward, there's still going to be an appreciable increase in the amount of energy required for AI-enabled data centers compared to the ones that we operate now.
I guess one obvious source that you might imagine that these tech companies could reach for would be renewable power. Why not renewable and why nuclear, do you think?
Well, I think it depends on what resources are available where these proposed data centers would go. In areas where there is renewable availability, that's exactly what we're seeing. I'm speaking to you from Ireland, and we have a very large and growing data center sector here. They have been very active in commissioning new renewable generating sites, particularly wind farms, and also purchasing the power from wind farms that have been built. I guess the issue here is scale and speed. The speed that generative AI has caught on and the speed that is expected to grow into the future is faster than what we've seen in the past. And then there's this massively increased energy demand that is going to be needed to fuel it. We're sort of running in many countries where we have renewable energy being brought online. We're nearly running to keep up with increases in demand. One of the drivers of that demand would be data centers. So I think with these announcements about the small nuclear reactors, what they're trying to do there is to get ahead of this running to keep up and try and build something large scale quickly.
Is there anything in the argument that although nuclear power is controversial, there are lots of people who do see it as being a good intermediate way, at the very least, of trying to wean us off our need for fossil fuels, that when you get these tech giants coming into the market and saying, right, we're going to buy up capacity or encourage new capacity to be built, which we will then have first dibs on, that actually it means that there's less capacity for the rest of us.
This is probably the crux of it. Certainly what we see in countries that are trying to build out renewables, and I'll refer back to Ireland here again, we're really building up renewables and we're just about keeping pace with increases in demand. And a big portion of that demand growth is data centers. When we're looking at this particular deal, what makes this interesting is the fact that the data centers here are promoting a new technology. It's giving an off-taker to electricity for a new technology that it might not have had. So there are some effects down the line here that might be difficult to predict, in that this could help a new zero carbon, stable, predictable type of electricity generation come to market faster than it would have in the absence of this data center demand. This is really where the argument is. With the growth in data center demand, are we reducing the supply available for everyone else, or are we in fact promoting opportunities for new technologies to get to market?
Rory Monaghan, Professor of Energy Systems Engineering at the University of Galway, on Google's plans to get at least some of its power from small nuclear reactors. You're listening to NewsHour. Much more to come in the next 30 minutes.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story podcast, where we're asking how the U.S. election could impact the war in Ukraine. With Kamala Harris and Donald Trump neck and neck in the polls, President Zelensky's campaign to ensure crucial funds don't run out is increasingly uncertain. So will the result in November change his nation's fate? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. What's the right approach to controlling the trade and misuse of narcotics? Singapore has a particularly tough approach. If you're convicted of trafficking drugs like heroin, methamphetamine or even cannabis in large enough quantities, you may face the death penalty. And it's also illegal to consume drugs in Singapore. If you're caught using any illicit narcotic, including puffing on a marijuana cigarette, you may find yourself in compulsory rehab. Linda Presley was given access to the state's austere drug rehabilitation centre, where drug users often spend months.
Singapore's Drug Rehabilitation Centre, or DRC, is located in a huge complex in the east of the island. When drug users are picked up, they may spend months here.
I'm Ravin Singh. I'm the second superintendent of Institution S1, which is primarily for first and second time drug abusers. There are about 500 or so of them.
Superintendent Singh shows us around. He takes us into an unoccupied cell that usually accommodates 7 or 8 men. At the back, there are 2 squat toilets and a shower behind a waist-high wall.
There are no beds.
There are no beds in any of our prisons, only in our medical wards.
But this is drug rehabilitation. It's not prison.
So while we rehabilitate you, we also want you to remember that it's not an offence that you should repeat.
So everybody sleeps on the floor?
On a mat, yes.
Inmates spend up to 6 hours a day in a classroom on psychology-based courses.
We're doing the exercise. I try to focus on my tapping, but...
Inside the bright, spacious room, there's a mindfulness session in progress. Around 15 men sit in a horseshoe around a course leader. For a young man I'll call Jack, reeling from a romantic breakup earlier this year, his drug use became more than a little problematic.
I was in public. I hadn't eaten or slept in 4 days. I was basically having a psychosis episode and the police were informed. During my time of use, I never thought it would ever happen to me.
This is Jack's second time in the DRC. He was here before in 2021. That's half a year incarcerated in the DRC and half a year being monitored in the community. But then Jack relapsed. This time as a repeat drug offender. He's going to be resident here for 8 months and then tracked outside for a further 10.
So in hindsight, when I think about my first sentence, I felt that I never actually did the work. This time, I felt like, because of the circumstance of how I was caught this time around, I felt that it was a big eye-opener.
Scary, right?
Scary. Very scary. Although being away from family, being away from friends is painful, right? Coming back here, I really needed to understand, to learn, to live a better life. So I cannot say that I will not come back, but I will do whatever it takes to stay on this journey of sobriety.
The words of Jack, ending that report by Linda Presley. You can hear more from what she found out in Singapore in this week's assignment on the BBC World Service, and you can find that anywhere that you can download the documentary podcast. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service with me, Tim Franks. And let's head back to the Middle East now. We've heard from Gaza early on the programme. We've heard about Iran. We're now heading to Lebanon because just before we came on air, Hezbollah's deputy leader, Naim Qassem, released a video message. One part was to say this to the Israelis.
I am telling the Israeli home front, the solution is a ceasefire. We are not talking from a point of weakness. If the Israelis don't want it, then we will continue.
And what he went on to say was that given that the Israelis are attacking all over Lebanon, Hezbollah will retain the right to attack all over Israel. The BBC's Jonathan Head joins us live from Beirut. Jonathan, what did you make of this address?
Well, I think it was probably pitched more to the Lebanese population and lots of appeals to unity, for patience, promises to rebuild their homes, saying victory would be theirs eventually, and warning that Israel has plans for a refashioned Lebanon and a refashioned Middle East if it manages to destroy Hezbollah. Remember, many Lebanese are very weary of this war. Large parts of the Lebanese population do not support Hezbollah at all and are very angry that it's dragged them into this war. And I think it was a call to them to stand firm with Hezbollah against the enemy. Also, interesting that reference to a ceasefire.
still, he said, that the issue of Palestine, the country Palestine itself, he said, and Lebanon cannot be separated. So if Hezbollah is thinking about a ceasefire, it is not a separate ceasefire from Hamas. There's been some speculation that with all the losses in its leadership recently, Hezbollah might possibly strike a separate ceasefire deal with the Israelis. Clearly, he's saying that can't happen as long as Hamas is still fighting.
And just in terms of, you know, how widely this Israeli assault on Hezbollah and Lebanon is being felt. New figures today from the UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, about just how many people in Lebanon are under these Israeli evacuation orders.
Huge numbers. I mean, basically, you know, more than a quarter of the country is under some kind of evacuation order. I mean, many communities get repeat evacuation orders. I don't think you could even keep up with them. And then we've also had these figures from the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, saying that there are now 400,000 children in Lebanon displaced by the conflict, most in the last 3 weeks, 3 weeks since the conflict escalated, 1.2 million not getting education. These are massive numbers in a population that's just over 5 million. This is it is a humanitarian catastrophe. But of course, if you listen to the protagonists, that message from Sheikh Qassem from Hezbollah, no sound of budging whatsoever. And of course, Israel insisting, you know, I think their view is now we must destroy Hezbollah's military capabilities, stop any possibility of repeat attacks over into northern Israel. And they're quite a long way from doing that. The attack over the weekend that hit that Israeli military base is a reminder that Hezbollah does have the capacity to cause damage. And if Israel's goal is to make sure that can't happen, there must be many more airstrikes. The airstrikes are increasing. We had a report of 200 from the Israeli Air Force across Lebanon yesterday.
Jonathan Head in Beirut for us. Thank you very much indeed. And indeed, the UN Human Rights Office has called for an investigation into the airstrike, which has killed 24 people in northern Lebanon earlier this week. Well, clearly those who are directly involved or caught up unwillingly in the conflict are those who are most deeply affected, be it in Lebanon, Israel or Gaza. But the impact of the war is being felt far more widely, including in one of the regional powers, Saudi Arabia. What, if anything, can they do to reduce the levels of violence and to prevent, in the first instance, an all-out war between Israel and Iran? Prince Khalid Al Saud is the Saudi ambassador to the United Kingdom. He's been speaking to my colleague, Sarah Montague.
By and large, I think most of us are trying to de-escalate the situation. You know, it's only a few weeks ago we were talking about ceasefire in Gaza, then a ceasefire in Lebanon. And what we're trying to avoid is having to discuss a ceasefire in Iran as well, and then, further conflict around the region.
How likely is it, do you think, that it will increase? We know that Israel's threatening a retaliatory strike.
Well, all the signs are that it's moving in that direction. You know, it's the same build-up we saw when they went into Gaza. It's the same build-up we saw when they went into Lebanon. I hope it doesn't escalate. We're closer to 1973 than we've ever been. And I think if we cross that threshold, we're closer to 1937 than we've ever been. That's how serious this is.
Before October the 7th, Saudi Arabia was on the brink of normalizing relations with Israel. Can you imagine something like that now?
The Crown Prince has been unequivocal in what he said. And the Crown Prince, during the opening of the Shura Council, said, unless we see a Palestinian state within the 1967 borders with East Jerusalem as its capital, there is no space for normalization. And while we should be working towards that normalization of peace, not normalization of violence, I just don't see that the direction of this Israeli government will lead to that, not now or in the future. I think what we're seeing is a country that was shaken and is, you know, the trauma of the 7th of October, not just in the lives lost and hostages taken, but the effect it had on the Israeli mentality of how it saw itself. But I think that they are reacting out of anger and trauma, maybe a little hate, and that is not how one resolves things.
But what does it mean for the hate that will then come from the people of Gaza?
Well, that's exactly the point. I mean, we're sowing the seeds of another cycle of violence. And each cycle, it's rather like a screw, gets further and further away from the result we want to be in.
Of course, historically, the United States has had a role in trying to stabilize things. Do you see it having any role given the current president and the possible two future ones?
Well, I mean, it's the most powerful country in the world. It's Israel's greatest ally. Of course it has a role. But I think the whole international community is failing. If we weren't failing, we would have a resolution.
And Saudi Arabia, of course, is critical to any resolution. Do you see some way forward, some way that Saudi can play a role to try to get to what you're talking about?
We're trying, you know, through our diplomatic efforts. Of course, we don't have a direct line to the Israelis themselves. But it's not just Saudi Arabia. You know, all of the countries of the region, not just are hoping for a resolution, are trying actively to use diplomacy and whatever tools we have. But those tools are limited.
I'm just thinking we're at a point where the world is waiting for what Israel is going to do. We're 3 weeks away from a US election. Are you nervous about what comes next?
Yeah, I'd be foolish not to be nervous. Everyone should be nervous. And I think for a long time now, we've been warning that things may, you know, explode in the region, and they have. The fact it's been a year, over a year now, and it hasn't turned into a regional war gives me some cause for, I wouldn't say optimism, but I'm hopeful that we might get somewhere. But that doesn't mean that it won't get worse, because, you know, we've almost forgotten about Gaza because of Lebanon. We've almost forgotten about Lebanon because of Iran. And we've almost totally forgotten about Jerusalem. I mean, we're seeing moves by the Israelis to take the land that the UNRWA headquarters on, seize it and turn it into a settlement. I mean, this does not look like someone trying to do the right thing for peace and stability. It looks like it's being deliberately aggressive.
The Saudi ambassador in London, Prince Khalid Al Saud. Close to 1,000 days into Russia's full-scale invasion of its neighbour, Ukraine is coming under drone attack almost every night. Across the country, the Air Force relies on a network of volunteer patrols to help protect the skies. And with many men now being called up to the front line, more women are stepping in to take on the task. Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford joined one patrol.
The unit call themselves the Witches of Bucha, because, with one exception, they're women, stepping up now that so many men have been deployed to the front lines. Ukraine is short of weapons too. The machine guns that the witches are assembling were made in 1939. They have to pour in bottled water as a coolant.
So Valentina's saying that the drones could see the light and could respond to that. They don't know how the drones are going to behave. So they're saying we need to work in the dark, essentially.
Of course, it's nervous work, because we need to be focused to react to the slightest sound.
Valentina is a vet. The commander, Yulia, has a day job as a manicurist. Her team have downed 3 drones so far. She says there are more in the air these days. And when I ask why, she shrugs. I think they want to kill us. The women joke a lot here, but they're all from Bucha. And at the start of the all-out invasion, they lived under occupation, when Russian forces killed and brutalized civilians here. Valentina tells me that experience is what's driving her now.
I remember all that horror. I remember the screams of my own child. I remember the dead people when we were fleeing. That's where I find the strength to go on.
It's what motivates all the women. So much that the Bucha witches spend their weekends doing more military training. This was them learning to storm a building, crunching through the ruins of an old farmhouse. There's a fair bit of back chat, and their gun skills are not entirely convincing yet. But the women are learning fast, and they call this empowering. Anya is an office manager who tells me how she felt totally useless during the occupation, unable to defend her family. And that was terrifying. And this is Ina. She's a maths teacher.
You cry and suffer for the people who are no longer here, those taken by the stupid war. Then they were recruiting women here, and I tried it and didn't fall apart.
Back at base camp, Valentina stokes the fire in a hut as rain hammers down on the roof. She's on patrol duty, waiting for the next air raid. She tells me the men who used to defend the skies here are now in Pokrovsk in the east, where the fighting against Russia is fiercest. So we try to smile and stay cheerful, she says. But we're just waiting for them to come back alive.
Sarah Rainsford with the Witches of Bucha taking to a patrol in Ukraine. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. This is the BBC World Service and live from London, you're listening to NewsHour with me, Tim Franks. Cervical cancer is one of the most common forms of the disease for women, the fourth biggest globally. And now a new treatment regime is being hailed as the biggest breakthrough against the cancer for 25 years. Researchers from University College London and its hospital have reported a 40% reduction in the risk of death from the disease and a 35% reduction in the risk of the cancer coming back within at least 5 years. Dr. Mary McCormack is honorary consultant oncologist at UCLH. Dr. McCormack, welcome to NewsHour. The key here, well, I'm asking the question rather than putting the statement, but is the key here the treatment regime?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for inviting me on. So we looked at 6 weeks of chemotherapy before the standard chemo and radiation, which has been the standard of care for 25 years, as you said. So half our patients in the trial got this additional treatment. And so we found that this short course of additional chemotherapy yielded an improvement in survival and in progression-free survival, which we're very excited about.
And do you know why this combination of chemotherapy ahead of the what's called chemo radiation, why that works so effectively?
Well, you know, our radiation and the chemo that we already have works very well to control the cancer in the cervix and in the surrounding tissues. But what has been happening is that we'll find that some patients will develop cancer or recurrence at a distant site. So, for example, in the lymph glands, maybe in the neck or in the belly or in the lungs. And so we think that by giving the chemotherapy this short course very quickly and early on, that we're helping to actually tackle any cells, any rogue cells that might have traveled but not yet grown, and get rid of them before they have a time to multiply and divide and form a tumour at another site.
Right, and you mentioned early on. I mean, I guess, as with so much cancer treatment, timing is crucial, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. So what we did differently in this study was we made sure that when we finished this short 6 weeks of chemotherapy, we were able to go in straight away in week 7 with the standard radiation and avoiding that sort of delay, any delay in treatment between this short course of chemo and the definitive radiation is very important.
I guess one of the things that's particularly exciting about this, apart from how incredibly efficacious it seems to be, is that we're not talking about sort of fancy, expensive new drugs. You're just talking about, you know, in a sense, the system of how the drugs are administered.
Exactly. It's using drugs that have been around for many years, but just sort of giving them in a slightly different way and making sure that we give the treatment week on week for 6 weeks and then go in with the radiation without any delays. So it's really just repurposing drugs that have been around that are no longer on patent, so they're cheap and they're affordable. So it should make this short course of treatment more manageable in lots of different health settings, not just in parts of the world like the UK and Europe, for example, or America, but also further afield, you know, in perhaps in Latin America, South America and Africa, where, you know, there's a very, very large disease burden.
Extremely exciting news. Great to have you on the programme. Dr. Mary McCormack, honorary consultant oncologist at University College London Hospital. That's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London, thanks for your company.
The race to become the next president of the United States is on.
We can't drop the pace now.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Count on the BBC World Service to keep you informed on the latest breaking news with insight and analysis you can trust.
Immigration, if you look at polls, a top concern for so many US voters.
The issue of the economy reigns supreme for everybody.
For a global perspective on the US election, search for The Global Story, the documentary, and The Global News Podcast, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.